Save Me Thousands is brought to you in part by RP Funding. RP Funding Inc. is licensed and can offer loans in Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Kentucky, Louisiana, North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, and West Virginia, and is also licensed by the Mississippi Department of Banking and Consumer Finance and by the Pennsylvania Department of Banking and Securities. Office is located at 500 Winterly Place, Suite 300, Maitland, Florida, 32751. Telephone 321-397-4420. RP Funding's nationwide mortgage licensing system ID number is 70168, Equal Housing Opportunity, and Robert Palmer's NMLS ID number is 76197.
We're saving thousands with Robert Palmer right here on the Saving Thousands Radio Network. Robert Palmer, the founder of RP Funding, is an author, well-known radio and television personality, and a public speaker dedicated to help you take charge of your money. In the next hour, you'll find yourself with a much better understanding of life's finances. So, Robert, you taught us long ago that the only real credit score that matters is our FICO score. And you've got their website open as we speak.
But there's so much great information in here. And if you just read around and look at it, it'll show you the different versions. That's my favorite thing about myfico.com. So there's different versions of FICO. There's the version of your credit score that gets used for mortgage lending, which for Equifax is FICO version 5. Then there's the, and it tells you, it says most commonly used in mortgage lending, and it gives it the score. And so I guess to give people kind of an idea of the range, so on a FICO 8, which is the newest score, I have a 788. On the FICO version 5, which is the one we use for mortgage lending, I only have a 766. On the FICO auto score, so this is one used by car dealers, FICO auto score 8, I have an 804. FICO auto score version 5, I have a 776. So you can see the scores. This is all FICO, too. This isn't the FICO scores. This we talk a lot about FICO scores. These are from FICO. This is the main company. But even they've got the different versions because I guess what happened is the industry said, well, you know, the whole idea behind this is they looked at all this data and they said, okay, right before somebody defaulted on a mortgage, here's what their credit looked like. And right before somebody defaulted on an auto loan, here's what their credit looked like. Uh-huh. And right before somebody defaulted on a credit card, here's what their credit looked like. And those are different, right? And so that's why I guess they have the different scoring models because the indicators and the triggers in your credit that mean you are in trouble and may stop paying your mortgage are different than the credit triggers and indicators that say you may stop paying your auto or your credit card.
Or like a boat.
Right. And now for some people, I mean, if you have a total financial disaster, you're going to quit paying everything, right? But there are people who didn't pay their mortgage but continue to pay everything else. Or there are people who maybe get one credit card and stop paying it, but they don't stop paying their mortgage. So I guess the whole idea of having the different versions of the scores is based on trying to give each creditor, each type of creditor, the best information because the whole point of this is it's a predictive number. The whole point of this is to predict the likelihood that you're not going to pay. So down here on the second section, it says, well, first it talks about what are my positive factors. And it says there's no evidence of serious delinquency. You've limited the use of your available revolving credit. We talk about that a lot. Yeah, having maxed out credit cards is a negative. You've recently been paying your bills on time, of course. You have many accounts that are in good standing. Yep. You've shown recent use of credit cards. So that's a positive. Uh-huh. You've shown recent use of credit cards. So someone who doesn't have any credit cards or doesn't use them at all, they don't get that positive. And then you have an established credit history. So even though on one version of the score they tell me I don't have an established credit history, on the new version they tell me I do. And then it says your risk to the lender. Each lender determines the information they access to evaluate consumer credit. Most lenders use FICO, and then it says my risk rate. So this is the risk rate that I will reach 90 days past due or worse, which would be a bankruptcy, an account charge-off, or a collection on any credit account over the next 2 years is 2%. So Equifax, TransUnion, Experian, based on the FICO score, all say I have a 2% chance of not paying my bills. So that means I have a 98% chance of paying my bills.
That's
really the real number that lenders care about. They use the FICO score as the representation, but the whole reason they pull the FICO score is that risk rate to try to predict what is the likelihood that you're going to default. Then it tells me that a FICO score between 740 and 799 is above average. Most lenders would consider scores in this range as very good and as an indication that you are a dependable borrower. Based on your score alone, you might expect the following. It is very unlikely that your application for credit cards or loans will be turned down based on your credit score. Most lenders will consider offering you very attractive and competitive interest rates, and many lenders will be able to provide you with an instant approval based on your credit score. Then they show me some potential rates I could receive. And that's it. So
there's a lot of information.
There's a
Robert.
Wealth of knowledge, and they've also got a great community on here. They've got great frequently asked questions. I'm a big fan. You know, I don't have any endorsement relationship with MyFICO. I don't have any affiliate. Like, they don't pay me anything. I don't make anything off of these guys. They don't even get a discount. I'm paying $59 for the report, just like everybody else is. But I think it's great information to have, and I use it a lot in my daily life. And as we talk about, the whole point of this show is for me to teach everybody the tools I use and the philosophies I use. And this is a big one. Rule number two, know your numbers. So again, the rules are, I wouldn't say the rules are completely in any type of order, but I will tell you that the top three, one, two, and three are very, very important.
Yeah.
Number one, shop around is the most important by far. Number two, to know your numbers is the second most important. And then number three, which is the three-day rule, which is before making any type of large purchase or signing for any type of credit or debt, you wait 3 days to sleep on it to make sure that it's a smart decision and that you're not just caught up in the moment and the hype. Those are the top three rules. But yeah, this is a big one. Knowing your numbers, knowing your FICO score, knowing your home value, knowing your credit card balances and interest rates, all of these are very, very important.
I would just think, let's look at the person going in to apply for a mortgage or apply for an auto loan. They are letting that dealership have complete control over them if they don't know their numbers.
Absolutely.
Because the guy says to you, well, David, I'm sorry. We just pulled your credit in the back room, and we're not going to be able to do this without an extra $5,000 down. How many times does that happen a day?
Yeah, knowledge is power. And this goes to, I forget the rule number. I got to post them in here. But if you know the tricks, they don't work.
Yeah.
You know, and so knowing your numbers and knowing the tricks really go hand in hand. I mean, really, it's just, it's a code to live by to not be taken advantage of. That's that at its very base. No one wants to be taken advantage of, right? Right now, you know, if you're out there listening to me, I want you to raise your hand if you want to be the next guy who's taken advantage of. You know, you want to be the guy that the credit card company or the car dealer or the mortgage guy is laughing at behind his back because they just stuck it to you so badly and they made their entire month's pay off of you. Nobody wants to be that person. No one wants to be taken advantage of. And the whole point of these rules is to keep that happening from you or for you, to you, not from you,
to you.
Happening to you. All right, that's it. We got to keep it from happening to you.
Yes, the Saving Thousands Rules to Success is the everyday guide, sort of your GPS to your money. Now, once you begin using the rules, you'll take charge of your money and you won't fall prey to the greed out there in the marketplace. And it's everywhere. Your copy of the 15 Saving Thousands Rules to Success can be found on our companion website, savingthousands.com. Simply open the site and note the row of tabs across the top of the homepage. One of those tabs says the rules. Simply click on it, and voila, there they are. That's savingthousands.com. Speaking of the 15 Saving Thousands Rules to Success, Robert, you have a rule pertaining to savings that's kind of different than the one taught by most people.
All right, so let's talk about this savings thing. Rule number 10. This is a big one. I want my financial ninjas to have 3 months of gross, your last 3 months of gross pay.
Why would that be such a factor?
All right, so here's the deal, Rob. I mean, we've all been through this.
Right.
One, I will say, I want to base it on gross pay because that's what we live on, right? So,
okay.
So a lot of people say, well, base your cushion on your debts. Well, or your budget. Well, the problem is, I mean, our budgets change. Things happen, right? You know, and what we really live off of is how much money we have coming in. And so, again, I don't want to do this based on net take home, right? Because then I want you to have a bigger cushion than that. So what I want you to do is I want you to look at your pay stubs. Look at your, if you get paid, you know, if you get paid twice a week, let's pull out the last six. That's not quite 3 months, but it's close enough. You get paid twice a month, pull out six. Actually, if you get paid every other week, pull out seven. So take your last seven pay stubs, add up the gross. If you get paid twice a month, pull out six. If you get paid once a month, pull out three and add up the top line, the gross pay to you.
Right.
And that's what I want. That's the number I want you to have in the savings account. And so one, if something happens, you lose your job, you get laid off, you hit on hard times, you're not going to pay taxes at that point. So you're going to have more because we're doing this based on gross pay and not net pay. So this is really more like 5 or 6 months worth of cushion because the tax goes away. Right.
Right.
But the big thing is, and the reason I want you to last 3 months, and you need to recalibrate this often. So what happens for a lot of people is all of a sudden something happens at work and they get really busy, right? And so you start working a whole bunch of overtime, you know, like in our industry, I run a crazy refi special. And so then all my staff works a lot of overtime.
Sure did.
And then they're getting these bigger paychecks. And so if you're looking back at your last three paychecks, when something like that happens in your life, it's going to force you to save the difference, right? So if you're humming along making $4,000 a month gross, and that 3 months is going to be a $12,000 savings, right? It's a decent sized number. It's a big number to have. But I think to have true financial security, this is the number we should have readily available in savings to truly survive any type of hiccups. This is how I've always done it. And so all of a sudden, then you work a bunch of overtime. And so now let's say you make $5,500 that month because you worked a lot of overtime. Well, now your savings requirement goes up from 12 to 13.5. Yeah. And so what that's going to force you to do is save that overtime money. It's going to force you to save that extra money because a lot of people's, you know, the mentality is we're making this extra money. Let's spend it, right? Or let's use it over here. Let's use it over there. No, my system, by looking back at your last 3 months, it's going to force you to put that money back into your savings. Mm-hmm. Because if you get a big commission check, it's now factored into your last 3 months of earnings. So you got to put it in your savings account. You know, if you get a raise, for the first 3 months of that raise, you're going to have to save everything just to keep up with the formula because you're making more money now and you're not taking it all home. So again, this is forcing people to save the way they should. Because when we first get a raise, it kind of almost goes in with the three-day rule as well. So when you first get a raise, you first have that big month, there's this kind of itch to go do the thing, you know, like, oh, now that I'm making X, I can go buy that new car. Now that I'm making X, I can go do this or I can go do that. And by forcing your savings pattern up as you make more money, right? So you get a raise, and all of a sudden you find your $2,000 in the hole on your savings account because the number went up, right? So if you had saved, let's go back to our $4,000 a month example. You save 3 months, you've got $12,000 in your savings account.
Right.
Okay, now you get a raise. You get a raise to $60,000 a year. So now it's $5,000 a month. Well, now over the next 3 months, that savings requirement is going to go from $12,000 to $15,000. So you when you get a raise, you find yourself in the deficit of what the rule says you should have. So the first 3 months of that raise, you've really got to save everything just to catch back up. And so what this forces you to do is it forces you to continue to live the lifestyle you were living before the first 3 months of your raise. And what we'll find is over that 3 month period, some things that felt like they were a really good idea, like maybe, oh, now that I'm making more money, honey, let's get a bigger house.
Yeah.
Oh, now that I'm making more money, honey, I'm going to get that Ford Raptor. I'm going to go buy a Corvette, right? I'm making more money. And what will happen is as the newness of the raise starts to wear off and you start to see the money going into your savings account, a lot of those, what I'll call harebrained ideas, right? And there's nothing wrong with having nice cars and everything else. Just think about it, you know, give it the 3 months. So this is kind of the extended 3 day rule in a way, because the savings pattern requirement of rule number 10 is going to force you to save whenever you have a financial increase, right? And the bigger your raise, the more you now have to put into savings. And so it may take you more than 3 months because again, when you get that raise, you're not taking home 100% of that. There's taxes, there's everything else. So it may take you 4, 5, or 6 months to accumulate the correct amount of savings to get back in line with the rule whenever you first get that big raise. Mm-hmm. But this is what's going to protect you from yourself. And this is what's going to make sure that when you do make that decision to buy the new car or to get the new house or to upgrade something in your lifestyle, that there's enough of a cushion. We've raised our cushion. We've raised our savings account. We've raised our emergency fund to go with our new earnings potential before we started tapping the money. And that's what most savings rules don't take into account, because they're just based on your bills. And they're not based on savings. They're not based on gross pay. They're not based on these things. So that is rule number 10. We're going to take our last 3 months of paychecks. We're going to add them up. And that's what I want you to have in the savings account.
Just think of the peace of mind if you did have the equivalent of 3 months' income set aside for life's emergencies. That would certainly lessen the blow when you lose your job or the car breaks down, not to mention sudden illness, surgery, and the list goes on. The problem is, most people have little or no money saved up, which compounds the problems. So an emergency occurs, and you're forced to somehow borrow the money at punishing interest rates or resort to selling of prized possessions. Rule number 10, have savings equal to 3 months' pay. So moving on, Robert, we get a lot of questions from our listeners dealing with fixing their credit. Most people recently are asking about those so-called credit repair agencies. You know, the ones with the plastic signs on the side of the road, they want $250?
You can dispute your credit yourself, right? A lot of people a lot of these companies out there are selling these services, and they call it credit repair, they call it whatever it is. And now, don't get me wrong, there are instances where having a professional on your side to help you put together a plan to improve your credit, I think there's some value to that. You know, there are some attorneys that do it. There are some people that do it right. But if all they're going to do is do disputes, and we're going to talk about what the dispute process is, there's really no reason to pay for that.
Are some of those lawyers that are actually trying to get people to claim bankruptcy and say, I'll get you out of all your bills, but now we're going to go through bankruptcy. I know there's the kind that say, give me $300, $400, and I'll go through and fix your credit by challenging the rate. But, you know, when we're going around like this, I think there's some lawyers that are doing that too, aren't they?
Yeah, again, you got to really understand what you're getting into. So if you've got an attorney who's going to hold your hand and walk you through the process and help you get back on track, that's one thing. Because really, it's almost at that point, it's more like credit coaching, right? You know, like you get a credit coach, and I think a lot of people could use a credit coach.
Amen.
You know, somebody to call you and hold you accountable on a monthly basis, you know, someone to help you make decisions. You know, we mm-hmm. do it here on the radio, but, you know, having someone actually looking at your situation to say, hey, I think you should pay this off before you pay that off, right?
Smart.
There is some value to credit coaching, right? Mm-hmm. And there are some attorneys who do credit coaching, and I'm all for that. Because there's a lot of interaction, and they help put you on a plan, and you're basically buying their expertise. Mm-hmm. There are other companies out there who all they want to do is take your money, and then they're going to dispute everything on your credit, which you could do yourself, and that's it. And they don't do anything else for you. So I think that's really, you got to understand what the relationship is, what you're getting. And so let's start with the very basics. What is a credit dispute, right? And so, Rob, we all as consumers, we have this file out there on us, right? We all have a file, and it's based on our Social Security number, right? And so, and actually, the funny thing is, they base it on, when you pull someone's credit, you're pulling with their Social Security number, but the credit files are monitoring name, address, zip code, date of birth, Social Security number, all these different things. Because if you think about it, when you go to, you know, say you get a collection from your cable company, they may not even have your Social Security number. So they don't have to always have your Social Security number to get it on your credit. So if the Social Security number is missing, they will look at, the credit bureaus look at your name and your zip code. And so this can cause problems, because if you're like a junior, like I'm a junior, and so luckily my father and I don't live in the same zip code. We live, you know, six, seven states apart. If we lived in the same zip code, then there would be a much better chance that his credit would bleed to mine or mine would bleed to his. Because if the name matches and the zip code matches, even if the Social Security number doesn't match, they assume it's you, and maybe the company didn't have your Social Security number right or whatever. Because the whole idea is Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian are trying to build this huge data file on all of us, and it's not always perfect. Because if you think, you may apply for a credit card over here under, you know, with your middle initial, this one over here without your middle initial, you know, your telephone company collection won't have your social on it at all these different things, and they have to try to compile it together. And so the point is, this is not a perfect process, right? And we, as consumers, we really have no say in what goes on our credit.
Sure.
There are things that we would like to see on our credit, right? Like, you know, there are people who pay rent on time every single month, and that doesn't go on their credit. It would help their credit. It doesn't go on their credit. They're talking about trying to build a new system where that can happen. Let's say you do a buy here, pay here car. You may pay that on time every single month. Doesn't show up on your credit. You may pay your cell phone bill every time, you know, every single month on time. That doesn't show up on your credit. So we as consumers can't control what shows up and what doesn't. And so this led to problems in the early days, because you would have erroneous information on your credit report. And there was, what do? You can't really get Mr. Equifax on the phone. You know, I mean, good luck getting anybody on the phone over there who can actually do anything about your credit. And so now they can sell you some stuff. If you call Equifax, they'll try to sell you monitoring and protection and this and that and the other, but they will not talk to you about things contained in your credit report. And so the dispute process was started to give consumers a way to officially notify the bureaus, hey, I think this account is erroneous, right? I never had an account with this company. You know, this is Robert Palmer Sr.'s account, not Robert Palmer Jr.'s account. You know, this is, I don't know where you got this from, right? So this is the point of the dispute process.
Early on in your life, when you were first starting your first company, didn't you have another Robert Palmer problem? That guy had just unbelievably bad credit and everything else?
No, it wasn't bad credit. It was a Ponzi scheme.
Oh, okay.
So this is a little sidebar. I'll tell this story. Yeah, so there was a Robert Palmer. I think he was even a Robert Palmer Jr. I mean, maybe a Robert W. Palmer Jr. Like, our names are... I know it was either the same middle name and the junior, or maybe a complete match. I'm Robert W. Palmer Jr., and I think maybe it was a complete match. And so this guy was in New York City, and he perpetrated what at the time was one of the largest Ponzi schemes in American history. Luckily, I was 4 years old when this happened.
Thank God.
Right? And so that was my explanation is, well, if I executed the largest Ponzi scheme in American history at 4 years old, we all have much larger problems than me being a criminal.
Those so-called credit repair agencies too often just want to take your money. As Robert explains, they get your payment of $250 up front, then they dispute all of the negatives on the credit report, and see, in that way, they're removing those accounts from the mix, however, very temporarily. See, if you were really late on those payments or you missed them altogether, oh, they'll reappear all right. So you'll still have the bad credit, and you'll be out $250. That's really not so good, is it? All right, Robert, we also have a rule that says not to gamble with the essentials, rule number 11. So once I've set back enough money, I better be darn careful with it.
And that is the amount we are not going to gamble with, right? That's the amount we're not going to day trade. We're not going to stick it into Enron. We're not going to pop it into the hot new tech stock because our buddy says we should. You know, that's the money we're going to put into something safe, whether that's a money market account, a mutual fund, a good stock index fund, you know, CDs, you know, put that somewhere safe. But two, you got to make sure it's readily available, you know. Yeah. And so I'm not necessarily going to say you got to keep it in your savings account, because short-term stuff you can still tap. And in case of an emergency, a lot of times with a CD, if you break it, all you do is lose the interest.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you put it in your savings account, you're not getting any interest right now at most banks. And so if you put it in a CD and have an emergency and have to break it, all you lose is the interest you would have gotten. Mm-hmm. And so you're back to square one. But if you don't have an emergency, you made some interest. And so if you look at it, and the penalties to break whatever you're putting in are no more than the interest you earn. And again, we're going to do shorter term CDs. Sure. You know, we're going to do things that we can readily get our hands on the money. You know, if you're in a mutual fund, you can get out of that usually in 24, 48 hours. You can get that liquidated.
Exactly.
You know, so we're going to have that. And the chance of you needing to tap the whole fund in 24 hours are rare. Because remember, as financial ninjas, we have credit cards. And you can use a credit card for almost 55 days before you pay any interest if you do it correctly. So if we're sitting here and something goes wrong, we can put the problem on our credit card, and we now have 55 days to get our money back out of our CDs, out of our safe investments, wherever they are, and then make the payment on the credit card before the interest ever kicks in. Mm-hmm. So this is all how financial ninjas are going to maximize the earnings while minimizing the interest by using credit and everything as their tools and not being afraid of it. So I think we just hit like five rules here.
Yeah.
And I think we hit the don't be afraid of credit, but don't abuse it. You know, we're hitting the savings pattern, rule number 10. We're all over the place. All these rules fit in nicely together. But so this is the key. So that's what I want you to do. Then beyond that, if you want to gamble with the other money, if you've got 4 or 5 times the amount I want you to have in savings, and you want to gamble on that hot new tech company, you want to gamble on MySpace, you know, back in the day, you want to gamble on Enron, you want to gamble, you know, Groupon had a huge IPO and flopped.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, but again, don't gamble with the essentials. Don't gamble with the basics. That's rule number 11. So we're not going to gamble with that savings fund. Mm-hmm. We're going to keep that in safe investments. We're not just going to let it sit in our checking account and draw zero interest either. So this is where you got to be smart as a financial ninja. This is what we're teaching you how to do. It's beyond just the basics. I know you're smarter than that. You know, we all get out of bed. We all know how to tie our shoes. You know, these are higher brain functioning types of things. You know, we can use a smartphone, we can snap selfies, we can tweet, we can Facebook. We're smarter than people give us credit for, and I believe that, and that's why I'm trying to teach you these advanced tactics of how to live like a financial ninja instead of the old easy way, which is be afraid of credit, don't have any credit, you can't handle it, you're not responsible enough, just put your money in a saving in your checking account, don't touch it, be afraid, don't put it in anything. Yeah, this is not giving us credit for the amount of intelligence and, more importantly, the amount of access to information we have today. I mean, the amount of research that a consumer can do today is insane. I mean, imagine back in the day, you know, when there was a scam going on, how did you find out? You know, I mean, you think about it. You call a couple friends and chances are they would have had no idea. Now with the internet, I mean, we've got social media, we've got instant live news mm-hmm. coming from Twitter, you know, Facebook, all these things, we're so connected. And we have access to so much information. If you want to invest, you know, if you want to research something you're going to invest in, you want to research a company you're going to do business with, there is so much information out there that we've got to take advantage of that. And we've got to be smarter consumers, and we've got to stop being financial zombies. We've got to take our head out of the sand, and we've got to utilize these advanced techniques that I'm talking about right here on the radio every week, every day.
Well, Robert, we're up against a hard break, so we're going to have to cut it short right here. But we'll be back in a few minutes, everybody, as you save thousands with Robert Palmer.